I'm going to call the meeting to order, even though I don't have a quorum, and we'll give Representative Hansen a chance when everyone comes in. We'll have one of the committee members move the bill. But Representative Hansen, why don't you just go ahead with an explanation of the bill and start. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina and members of the committee. House File 769 moved through a couple of committees last year when we were looking in the finance year to receive $1 million to go to the University of Minnesota for some basic agronomic research on native plants. As you know, Representative Junkie and I think are the two soil scientists in the legislature, and there's a lot of research that's going on relating to maybe the wildlife impacts of native plants, or what the carbon sequestration is, or mixes. But basic agronomic research like seed viability, yield, response to water, response to nutrients, pest management, the things that we know with corn or soybeans over 60 or 70 years of research, do we know what 1 acre of switchgrass would grow in southeastern Minnesota compared to northwestern Minnesota? How it responds to various inputs? We don't have that type of research. You know, a year later, as I'm in front of your committee, I don't know if we have $1 million to do the research, but I think it's important to keep asking this question when we're talking about research. We're talking about biofuels and energy production is basic things for a farmer to know. If I plant this, what's it going to yield? How do I manage it? Some of those basic agronomic tools that the university could do. And that Subdivision 2 also has a technical advisory committee to work with the university and the Department of Agriculture to help get the research going.
Well, Representative Hansen, you know that there probably isn't a lot of money to work with this session. We did do some things last year regarding putting money in the base at the agricultural school at the university, but I think they're sitting on the LCCMR that there were a lot of there was a lot of discussion on native plants and plant breeding and things like that. Have you talked to Representative Genius about what's being funded out of the LCCMR, similar to what you're requesting here?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm aware of what's been going on with LCCMR.
I hate calling it that.
To get information. I think what my bill does is refines it more in terms of looking at the whole picture of what mixes, what works, but trying to get data that the landowners could use so they'd have knowledge about what they plant. I mean, when you think of corn, you know the number of seeds per plant population you want to have, you know the row width, you know your nutrients. Those are things that have been provided by university research that's been out there in the field. There's a lot of good research coming from you, and I know the LCCMR is providing that. What this does is trying to get that basic agronomic information so that folks can use it in the field, so that they'll know what to plant, what that viability is, and how they can move into larger production.
Any other questions on the bill? If not, Representative Mahoney then moves that House File 769 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education and Workforce Development Bill. Other questions? Anybody from the audience? If not, all those in favor signify by saying Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I guess to that motion, I'm just wondering why that wouldn't be in the agriculture bill.
It's appropriation to the University of Minnesota, and it came from Representative junkies. Sometimes I forget my roommate's name. Junkies at committee and team here in Appropriations University.
Thank you.
We had a number of those, remember, in the bill last year. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion for bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hampton, Representative Hodge. Representative Hodge is here. There he is. Representative Fly would move that House Bill 2939 be recommended to pass and held over, maybe held over, for possible inclusion in
some more.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your time and the committee's time. This bill, as most of you know, will remove the 60-credit maximum for AAS degrees throughout our colleges. This is an issue that was brought to my attention over the summer, and as I continue to look into this, it was evident that this not only affected my local technical college, but our colleges throughout the state, whether it be in St. Cloud or in Wilmer with their A program, or in Alexandria, or pretty much any college that we have. The 60-credit maximum essentially takes every single program that offers an AAS degree and forces them to get an exemption to this law. And for me, that just kind of seems a little overburdensome. I have no problem with oversight and making sure that this curriculum and course load for a degree is not too much for our students. Tuition is always a concern. But I also have a concern when our administrators and our different programs throughout the state have to ask for an exemption when we know it's already going to happen. With my research, not only in Minnesota, but through technical colleges throughout the state, almost every AAS program exceeds 60 credits. And I think it's important to allow them the latitude to work with our employers, establish programs, and meet the needs of our employers throughout the state. So that's why I'm here today. I'm happy to listen to suggestions from the committee or from the student group or anyone that may have concerns.
Questions from the committee. Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hodge, for bringing this forward. I've also heard from colleagues of mine that are concerned about this regarding the Associate in Applied Science degree. I also have a question, though, about other associate degrees like Associate of Fine Arts degrees. And I'm not sure, I guess, that this would only deal with the AAS degrees, and I'm not sure if that's enough of a catch for everything. And so I just wanted your response on that.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Representative Poppy, thank you for the question. I drafted the language just to apply to the AAS degree, so that's where I was seeing most of the concern with that particular degree. I'm open to suggestions, as I stated, but I also want to make sure that the original intention of this legislation is somewhat honored, to make sure that there is, you know, that we don't have runaway credit loads for a lot of our programs. So I'm willing to listen to the input, but right now I just focus on the AAS degree because that's where I saw evidence of the greatest need to address the change.
Other questions, Representative Hodge?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have received quite a few calls on this, and I was wondering what the administration of the schools are doing. I mean, I praise you for bringing this bill forward, but I was wondering why the administrations were not bringing a bill forward or saying that this is painful. I didn't hear from any students. I've heard from teachers, you know, and then they also can go through a waiver program. But I was wondering if there is an opinion of the tech colleges or the administrations of the tech colleges.
Maybe I can try to handle that when Representative Haas, you know, they put together this committee of, I think, students, faculty, administration, that looked at this proposal, which was mine from last year. You know, thank you, Representative Hodge, for recognizing the intent of it was because some places were requiring for a similar degree more credits than other places. And I don't know if I agree with you, and maybe you have some research to document otherwise, but the AAS program I thought was kind of somewhat unique.
here in that when we combined our technical and community colleges, there was the aspect of having still some liberal arts credits for the technical program, and maybe council, I don't know if they have any more research on it. I mean, I shot this one from the hip, but it was well-intentioned. And that's why I did give the waiver period and or the waiver and give quite a bit of time to implement it. Now, when I was traveling around the state this summer, Representative Haas, I heard from a number of mostly faculty who were concerned about their specific program, and I told them about the timeline, about the waiver process. I would hope that we still can see what happens as this moves forward, because there were things that I didn't think could be justified in degrees that had numbers. And, you know, when the schools are hurting for revenue, and you know what happens, if the pressure gets put on the students for tuition, and also might get put on it for, you know, having to take a few more classes. And I don't know if that's the case or not, but I would hope we'd let see how it works, and maybe we've got a few students, I think, that want to comment on this. Maybe they want to complain on it. Mr. Yopi, where's JJ around here? Is he here? Oh, there he is. So we've got a couple of students. If you don't mind, Representative Haas, they want to come down. I don't know if they're going to be for you or against you, but Representative Poppy, did you have a question of Representative Haas?
I will have probably another question. Mr. Chair, I did want to say that an associate in arts degree is primarily liberal arts, that you can have some technical credits within the associate in arts degree, but the associate in applied science is primarily career or technical with, I think, 21 credits, if I remember correctly, and we maybe have an NSCU person, but 21 credits of general ed. So and that's pretty much, you know, determined that you can't sway from that 21 credits of general education. So that's why I think the AAS concern is the people are saying we still need this many career credits in order to actually prepare our students to be able to go into the job market and meet the needs of the, you know, the whatever the occupation is. So I just wanted to add that.
Well, Representative Poppy and members, and I was, I think, one of the few around the table, maybe the only one here when the, maybe Representative Gunter was here, but I don't think he was, when the marriage between the community college and technical college system happened. And my understanding was this was kind of as a result of that, and that Minnesota was unique in requiring some of the liberal arts credits for a technical degree. But I could certainly be wrong. I've been wrong in the past. I'll admit it to the world. I will admit as a politician that I do make mistakes, so unlike some others. Welcome to the committee, and in fact, I should have probably not gotten up this morning, but go ahead, welcome, and
I'll let Jordan start the chairman. So.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to present the student's opinion on House File 2939. For the record, my name is Jordan Brandt. I'm the Vice President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. We represent over 100,000 public two-year college students. Yeah, I'm sure you're all aware, last year the higher education omnibus bill contained a provision that required Minsky to adopt a policy which would cap the limit for associate degrees at 60 credits and bachelor degrees at 120 credits. Prison also required Minsky to provide a process for a degree to be exempted from the cap under certain circumstances. Following the passage of the provision, the Office of the Chancellor did convene a task force to create a policy and procedure draft to comply with those provisions. And along with our association's president, I was a member of Minsky's task force on degree credit caps, so I know this issue very well. Last session, you heard testimony related to a different subject that pointed out the fact that Minsky campuses are granting AAS degrees with similar names but different credit requirements. For example, an AAS in Natural Resource Technology at Central Lakes College is awarded at 64 credits, while an AAS in Natural Resource Technology at Vermilion Community College is awarded at 72 credits. And I think, you know, it's easy to be dismissive of what seems like at first glance similar credit figures on a spreadsheet. I would implore the committee to view those figures through the lens of a student in which those numbers represent real dollars. The Vermilion, where the cost of attendance is $145.81 a credit. The credit disparity means $1,166 to the students. And unfortunately, the example I just gave you is by no means atypical. And while serving on the task force, it became clear to us that one of the most formidable challenges facing the committee was what to do with the Associate of Applied Science degree. The AAS degree is unique because it was designed to be a terminal degree to train students to move directly into the workforce, not necessarily as a transfer degree. The AAS, or the AS, is very similar, but it's also different in design, as it can be used by a student as a terminal degree or a transfer degree. It was apparent to the task force members that this entire piece of legislation was dealing with a very complex system that affects students, faculty, colleges, and universities in very different ways. Make the process complicated when you factor in how the AAS degrees utilize program advisory committees as part of the process. The workforce also has means of providing input to the final course learning outcomes. The challenge of creating a policy and procedure which would satisfy all the interested parties seemed insurmountable at times. But the end result of the committee's work, I think, shows that a compromise was indeed possible. And the task force recommended a process that allows for a waiver or exemption for any program offered on a Minsky campus following a detailed review of those program standards. The process recognizes the unique nature of many programs across the state and allows for each program to apply for an individual waiver to ensure the continued success of that degree being offered. And further, the process allows both a statewide or regional examination of similar programs to ensure that all the degrees are offering the number of credits necessary to properly educate students. Also, the process takes into account the role of the program advisory committees, which help guide many of the more technical programs that might seek an exemption. In fact, the criteria used to determine whether a waiver is necessary specifically states that support of local employers will be given strong consideration. So as this process worked itself out, it became quite clear that if a program is truly in need of a waiver from the CAP, the process would certainly allow for that waiver to be granted. And granting a blanket exemption for AAS degrees would short-circuit the principles of the legislation, and that is the need for programs to do a detailed examination of their offerings to ensure that the credit level of each program is at the appropriate level. Further, the proposed implementation date for the AAS degree is still several years out, and as the examination of programs continues, it's likely that there will be plenty of time for clarifying legislation if that is indeed necessary. I believe, Mr. Chair, that you designed the original legislation requiring the credit craft to save students money and provide some consistency amongst the degrees within the system after a thorough review of all programs and degrees while allowing exemptions when they were justified. To be clear, I don't think that a blanket exemption through legislation is the correct approach, and the process that the task force has created will allow for the original intent, as we understood it to be accomplished. And it's our hope that at the very least, we can give the process a chance to work and let its efficacy be reviewed at a later date. And I certainly understand Representative Hosh's position and know there are concerns within his district. But I point out that the task force had members from the college and university faculty, students, administrators, and the office of the chancellor. So everyone's concerns were heard loud and clear, and we were still able to come to a conclusion on the proposed policy and procedure. And therefore, we hope you can hold off on moving on this bill and give the work and the proposal that came out of that task force a chance to do its job before we go out and grant a blanket exemption. Thank you again for the opportunity on this important issue, and I certainly stand for any questions you have.
Well, members, I can tell you this isn't a setup because I didn't know what he was going to say either, but Mr. Brandt, I have to tell you, you're wise beyond your years. Anyhow, questions, Mr. Brandt? Representative Ott.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would also like to hear from anybody in the audience that knows how the reviews of the waivers are going and if they're adequately moving.
Mr. Brandt, you're sitting on the
Yes, the task force has actually concluded its work. There were 23 members of the task force, and we had a 5-6 hour meeting. I think about 690 man hours went into coming out with the process. And now that moves on to Linda Baer. And so there's still a few years before schools will have to go after these exemptions. So that's still working its way through the Minsky system at the chancellor's office level.
A follow-up?
I love the answer. I just didn't totally understand it. I probably missed the course in listening there somewhere.
We've all had that problem here.
The faculty people that have been calling me are saying that this is not working, and then I've been telling them, well, there is a waiver process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're going into this waiver process. How many people have, how many different curriculums have applied for that waiver?
I don't believe that.
You know that
it's at the point yet where they would be applying. And I'm getting a no nod from Dr. Lopez up there. So, I mean, we haven't even reached that level yet. So I would be surprised to hear from faculty that it's not working already when it's yet.
I didn't mean to apply. I was asking, is it working?
Okay.
I wasn't implying that it wasn't working. I was just wondering if it is working. Are there going to be curriculums reduced because the waiver process, are the curriculums going to be reduced now before the waiver process takes effect? Do they? Is it an immediate reduction?
No.
I think we're still giving it a chance to put together the criteria, you know, how they're going to move forward. This task force has done that. And then you have that timeline of January 1st of next year. So. But I'm curious because, you know, one of the reasons that I had asked you to support this last year was because of the discrepancy. So just for a quick synopsis here, what was the difference between the program at Central Lake College and at Vermilion Community College when there was another 8 credits at $141.85?
Per credit,
yeah. I mean, what was the difference in the programs to justify the higher credit requirements?
I don't know if I want to go on record saying there was something to justify that. It's just that, different institutions, this is happening in all kinds of programs, feel that they need different curriculum to satisfy something that's under the same degree. You know, when you look at sort of the end of the road here when these institutions have to put this into the federal SIP code and they enter it under the exact same name of degree, I mean, it's difficult for students to accept that these are exactly the same, yet at this school it will cost me this much, at this school it will cost me a different amount. So without going into each course required by those two institutions, we just like you to take a look at the disparity in credits.
Okay, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if this is a question or a comment, but I have heard a number of people have gotten some emails regarding the AAS degree and some of this, and I'm just wondering a couple of things. I guess is if a program has an accrediting body, for instance, I think surgical technology or radiography or something, if they've got an accrediting body that says this is okay, the number of credits, is that part of the waiver process that's sort of automatic then that they're allowed to do that?
That would certainly be taken into consideration in the waiver process. And it's fairly flexible in looking at that even, you know, within regions, different curriculum is required to serve the industries in that region. So that's certainly, the waiver process takes into account a wide variety of things. And that would be one of them.
Okay. And then just one other question, I guess. I probably am just in thinking through this and dealing with just the associate in applied science degree, I'm thinking about at my college we have an associate of science degree in nursing that I believe now is up to 74 credits, actually. So, and it's probably one of the highest numbers of credits for a nursing program in the system. And I know that as a counselor there, I was very concerned that that was going to be that high, where the nursing faculty are saying this really helps us to build, more, add more skill level and education to our students, and so they saw it as a benefit. I think there's a little bit of a marketplace issue, I guess, that, you know, for us, you know, if my college determines to do that, and we are able to seek and retain students, and they're coming and they're paying that price, versus a neighbor for us is Rochester Community and Technical College, and they have maybe a 68-credit system. You know, I think there's probably maybe a little bit of a sense of local control here that, you know, it's nice if the campus or the college is determining this is what we feel our needs are based on what we think our students are going to need, what the industry will need in our area, what our advisory council is telling us to do, whatever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, I certainly understand where you're going with that, and I, you know, I think it becomes a question of where do we actually draw the line. I think, you know, any student could always benefit from more credits. I'm sure a student taking a French class could benefit from, you know, spending a year there too, and that would be lovely. But when we are, what we're really, I mean, getting at is this credit creep here where students are having to pay more and also spend longer time working on their degrees. And, you know, of course, I mean, the more credits you can take, the better educated you will be. But I think we need to figure out somewhere to draw the line, and that the process the credit cap task force came out with is a good place to start to do that.
Representative Eastland, and I know Representative Eastland has a bill that probably may or may not be well received by the Minsky system either, that talks about some conformity and equality. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, this is a difficult issue, and I can really sympathize. I do have a tendency to agree that there should be some independence of campuses to be able to make some of their own self-determination. But I'm having a little problem defining better by being more credits. I think better is defined by a higher level of rigor and packing more into the classes that you're getting. I think there's some issue, some room to move on both sides here, but I guess maybe my thought would be is why couldn't this task force or this, when people are looking for a waiver, couldn't the system create a range of credits that would be acceptable to have your degree, to be degreed, and so you know for this particular major you could be between 60 and 68 credits or something, and because once we start getting, so I mean the difference here to get to 72 as opposed to 64, I mean it's $1,000 and it's probably another chunk of time out of your life. I don't know if you can get it in the same number of attendance days that you're dealing with. So I mean I just see something here that seems like we should be able to find a better way to do it, because our goal has to be to get kids out and through the degreeing process as fast and efficiently as we can and have them as best prepared as they can be, and it seems like we're kind of arguing about something here that is really slowing that whole process down, and it seems to me there's some answers that we should look at from a system standpoint. There needs to be individual schools can be making some decisions, but there needs to be some parameters that we establish throughout the entire system that we work inside of. So everybody is playing by the same rules, and then if you have a better program, people are going to go there because they're going to get a higher level of rigor, and you're going to get a better chance of getting a job when you get out. To me, it seems like that's the way it should work, not just kind of a haphazard, I want more credits, and the more credits means the better your education. I just don't believe there's a correlation there.
Well, members, you recall we started off last year by listening to students, which, from what I understand, was a first around here. And that's what this whole system's about, is students. And they're, you know, anywhere from young adults to middle-aged folks, quite a few younger than me, just a few years younger than me, but yeah, that's what we're attempting to do here, and this might not have been the perfect solution, but I think it's still got some time to work, and I appreciate your comments on maybe there's some suggestions we can take from the Minsky system itself now when we've had this task force. But you can hear the students
the ones we're all here for, whether we're at this table on this committee or in the audience as members of Minsku administration or faculty. That's the reason we're here, is because of them, and they've given us their comments, and so maybe we can mull it over for a while. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to kind of piggyback on this, I guess I was kind of unaware that we had put these limits on last year, and I, honestly, I think it's a great thing. I had two kids go through St. Cloud State University. The second one's still going through, but one of the things that I noticed as they were going through was there was a continual creep on general courses that were required in order for them to get a four-year degree. In fact, it no longer became a four-year degree. It became a five-year degree. And so we were putting on some general education, I'll say, some of which I had some significant questions as to their validity. But all it was doing was really protracting and extending the amount of time required and the amount of dollars that were invested. So I think the purpose of this is a good proposal to say, hey, look, if you can't put your major within a certain criteria, 120 credits for a four-year or 60 for a two-year, is not necessarily a bad thing. However, I guess what I'd like to do is say, where are we ever going to take a look at the general education requirements that it requires for a two and a four-year degree? I think part of it is transparency between the 2 years, so those are portable over to the four-year if you want to continue your education. And I think Minsku has been working with the technical colleges on doing some of that. I know they have in St. Cloud. But the other question comes into bear: are we really putting students out the door with a four-year degree that's valid enough to get them a job in the marketplace? And I think there's also been a good discussion here about the sciences, the math, some of those biology, and some of the sciences that are on the horizon that are the ones that we need to begin to focus on. But I think in that context, this whole process of taking a look at what are the valid numbers needs to go even deeper. I mean, I really believe that if we are really a higher education committee, then we need to take a look at what are the minimum requirements in general education and what are we doing to make sure that these kids, when they get out the door, have a four-year piece of paper that will actually get them a job instead of just giving them a false sense of security. That's my real concern, is that that happens, and I'm seeing it happen on an increasing basis.
Well, Representative Stevenson, you're on this committee, and we certainly can, you know, should you choose to go that route, to do a little more in-depth on that issue you're bringing up, I'm more than happy to get the proper folks up here to address it. Representative Hans again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if there is going to be any faculty that has been concerned about this issue give testifying today, or if there is going to be administration of the tech colleges give testimony or opinion.
Well, I see Representative Haas is chomping at the bit to talk again, and we'll have him come up. And I don't know if anybody, there's people in the audience from Minsku, I don't know whether or not they want to testify. But Representative Haas, although Representative Norton, can you hold your question and Poppy?
Yes.
No, Representative Haas, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Haas, the faculty that contacted me and I've been in contact with, I'm really wanting to be down here today, but I think the Chair Rukavina scheduled this on their spring break, so they couldn't be here.
Because
of the break, they're unable to be here. I do have over a dozen letters from interested parties, from Alexandria to Wilmer to St. Cloud State to the surveyors group to farm and aid groups that are concerned on this issue. There may be some people in the audience that want to testify to this.
Well, and well, as you're coming down, I just want to say that I've heard those concerns. I've heard them in, when we were out in Wilmer. I heard them from agricultural people. I heard them in Anoka when we were there from folks in a mechanical program. But I've talked about the timeline
and the waiver.
And we're hearing from the students who drive the whole system. Representative Haas.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure I could address Representative Eastwood's comments. I there's so many statements here today that I couldn't agree more with, whether they're from the students or from committee members. I do definitely want to see consistency when it comes to our degrees throughout our colleges and technical colleges in the state. However, I do have some concerns with the process that's set up, because it seems overly bureaucratic, in which every single program that offers an AAS degree is going to have to go through this system. If we're going to spend time and resources having oversight when it comes to the credit load of our AAS degrees, I think we can do it better without having to go through an application process for an exemption. I don't know what that is, but the reason I brought the bill forward today is so we can have that discussion, because I know there are some sincere concerns with the current mechanisms in place. And I hope we can do that, and I appreciate the committee's time, and if we lay this over, we can have time to further discuss this.
I appreciate your comments. Mr. Brant, and then you want to come up.
Mr. Chair, I understand it around here, certainly in the media, calling a process bureaucratic can give it sort of a negative tone, but I'd like to say that, you know, I think that Minsky did a great job of making sure that all kinds of stakeholders that are affected by this were heard. And I know that there may be some faculty out there, maybe it specifically affects their program, maybe they have other concerns, but faculty were represented on the task force, and I think we ultimately came to a consensus, and you know, everything that they had to say was heard loud and clear. And also, I'm on my spring break, and I'm happy to be here.
I was going to comment on that, Representative Hosh, because you think they on their spring break, if it was such an important issue, that they would be here, whereas as opposed to teaching, they might not have the problem. Yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Rukavina, members of the committee. My name is Manuel Lopez. I am with the Office of the Chancellor in Academic Affairs, and I chaired the task force. It was a cross-section of our constituents, faculty from both two-year and four-year institutions, administrators from both two-year and four-year institutions, a president from each of the two types of institution, general type, plus other administrators. We followed the law as specified in the last session, and we think we've come up with a workable process. In terms of the process, it could, in its simplest form, it's a two-page application. In its most complex, I can't tell you because we haven't encountered that yet. The policy doesn't go into effect until January 2009. What we've done, knowing that the policy is fairly simple to write, the issues, the procedures that we will develop, that's what the charge of the task force, to come up with the procedures and the criteria for waiver as indicated in the legislation. To address some of the other comments that have been made, I thought I might just give you some insights. So there has been a policy on program length, and there were ranges in those. Now those are exceed your current legislation that we're speaking about. The current range in baccalaureate degrees is 120 to 128. In associate degrees, we have anything from 64 to probably 80 something, and those also seek exemptions. So exemptions have been part of life for a long period of time, and I don't want to bore you with the details. And it's not just the AAS. The AAS, special cases like the nursing, also have options for waiver, and the BA and BS degrees are also going to undergo review. Ideally, the reviews occur on campus, and then it's a fairly simple, by the faculty and the administration, then it's a fairly simple form just to notify us. And the more extensive, detailed process will only come in terms of those programs where there's inconsistency, and then it is our responsibility to call faculty and administrators together and iron out those inconsistencies.
So, Mr. Lopez, with the process with this particular piece of legislation and the bureaucracy that we set up, any more cumbersome or burdensome than what the process was for going outside that range or on the top of that range?
No.
Within the system?
No. It's a little bit more specific, and it takes the current ranges and reduces them, but the process is essentially the same, except that the process that's in place is for new programs, and those are relatively reasonably few to come in every year. The process we're dealing with will essentially address 70% of all programs that are out there, but in a process taking a couple of years and in a systematic fashion and in ways that we don't think are going to be overly onerous.
And let me just ask, the process that you had in place within the system itself and at the campuses themselves, did you ever turn down any requests to expand?
Yes, but following what the guidelines that we have there. And I'm going to say yes because I can't fathom not having, but we don't generally broadcast the rejection.
And then did those facts, they go to their state legislator and ask them to bump up the credit?
No comment.
Okay. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't here from the very beginning, so I apologize if I'm covering some of the same territory, but I was compelled by Representative Severson's comments on you send your child to school and you expect after 4 years, or at least that was the old expectation, that they would come out with a certain set of skills, and that it has taken longer and longer now, at least that's been my experience with my four children, to get those 4 years of education, and it is usually taking five. But I'm trying to balance that with what the bill's intent is, the changes that were recently made with, I guess it's a balance between cost and product outcome, and I'm wondering if you know what happens nationally and internationally in this area. I would hate for our students not to be competitive with other community college graduates, AAS degree students, or any level if we're limiting ours and other schools are not. And frankly, I guess I do believe that going to more school, sound really intelligent, I won't even use proper grammar, more school produces more knowledge, potentially produces better, more qualified students. So I would disagree, I think, a little bit with my colleague here on that. So I guess I'm just looking to see, have you looked at, and how does this fit nationally and internationally, and what will this do to our Minnesota state of higher education?
Mr. Lopez, can you shed some light?
Chair Rukavina, Representative Norton, it varies in the United States. But I can give you an example. Our neighbors in Wisconsin, the baccalaureate's 120 credits generally. It's not 128. They have room for exemptions. Your engineering degrees tend to go longer. Your nursing degrees frequently tend to go longer. In both cases, you have national accrediting bodies, plus actually in both cases also licensing requirements. There are states where there are caps of 60 or 64 credits on AASs, and there are states where they're more flexible, such as ours. I like to think, well, my simple response is usually that historically we inherited the process we inherited now, so the 72 credits is a historical artifact. Some people think that's a little simplistic of an answer, but it is a possible answer. We did have, unlike some other states, a distinct technical college and community college system, which is not necessarily the case elsewhere. There are other. And you will find variations, but you will also find a large number of institutions across the United States in different states that baccalaureates that are at 120 and associate degrees are at 60, with the opportunity in those states that have either a coordinating board or a system office to grant waivers in those cases where it's justified.
Okay. Representative
Posse, did you say? Yes, Mr. Chair, I did, for Mr. Lopez. You said that the range for associate degrees was 60 to 74, I think, 60
there,
to something.
There are a few programs that actually exceed 80, but those tend to be, I'll give you the classic example. There's one that's astronomical in the 90s, but it's an FAA certified program, and the dictates of the FAA say you must have these courses in order to qualify for FAA licensure. So a program such as that, which is where it's very specific to the outside licensing and accrediting bodies are setting them up, we have a few of those. We have relatively few of those, but we have a few of those that exceed 72 credits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just again, a follow-up on that. Do you have a sense of, just assessed for the AAS or AS degrees, how many of those would fall closer to the 60 credits? I'm just trying to get a sense of if 60 is for, you know, A degrees, but maybe 64 is a more realistic approach for career degrees.
A lot. Representative Poppy. I suspect that it varies by discipline. I can't tell you that there are quite a few programs that are in the 64 range, but the vast majority of our programs, based on experience, would be in the 72 credit range. I would hazard a guess that in excess of 80% of our programs are 72 credits or more, and relatively few at 60.
In the AAS.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then just a question about the waiver process currently. You talked about the number of, certainly if my college has some of those higher level credit-based programs, they've come forward and they've gotten a waiver probably. Is that waiver going to be able to hold them in this next process? Are they going to have to seek another waiver?
As we approach this process and the language of all the legislation, we felt it was a good opportunity to review all the programs. As I indicated, it could be as simple as a two-page redesign. I think it gives us an opportunity to look at programs, and including those that have previously been waived, I think we need to look at. We have, because of, again, a national accrediting and licensing issues, waived programs in engineering that go beyond 128, which is our present limit on baccalaureate. There are a few that are actually at 124, so it's doable. So we will review those and look at where perhaps not so much the engineering curriculum will be addressed, but maybe a fewer number of pre-electives might be the result. So we would like the opportunity to look at them all, at least in a basic format, not necessarily in great detail. A lot depends on the nature of the program.
Yeah, Representative Haas, and then we'll round it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Our number of the bill.
Are we getting one degree, say, maybe in civil engineering or whatever that a major is? Is that going to have a set amount of credits for all the colleges then? Or is this going to be spattering and different in some colleges?
Representative Haas, we have reached an agreement within the committee that the process would look at, similarly named programs will be looked at. If we look, our intent is, if the legislation holds, to call the engineering deans and schools together and faculty and talk about credit length. The program at, let's say, St. Cloud and the program at Mankato, which are our two biggest engineering programs, would be capped at the same credits. The way the programs are structured would be structured by the individual institutions based on the strength of their faculty and their orientation of their program. But my sense would be that given the legislation as it was passed, that we want the consistency so that all electrical engineering or all civil engineering programs would be the same credit length. They would be capped at the same credits. They would not necessarily be cookie-cutter degrees. A lot would depend on the specific faculty and their expertise and the sub-areas that they tend to promote.
Follow-up question?
Sure.
Am I understanding you're going to look at all the degrees, or you're just looking at the degrees that are being asked for waiver?
We Representative Potts, we intend... The process is actually pushed back to the campuses. It's an existing process. Curriculum is the purview of the faculty and the institution. They will do the review on their campuses. They will go through the process that they go through for curriculum review, and they will forward requests for waivers. The actual bulk of the work is done at the institutional level, where they can look at how their programs implement or affect other programs, similar or programs that utilize the same basic core. And then the request for waiver would come to us. And those requests for waiver can be as simple as 2 pages. And our intent is only to look at the requests for waiver. The institutions can agree, and some institutions in our system have, for instance, in the past, during conversion to semesters from quarters, both Minnesota State University, Mankato, and St. Cloud State University did some of this review, and some of their baccalaureates were cut to 120. on an initiative of the president, Minnesota State University Moorhead, went through a process roughly 4 or 5 years ago where a large number of their baccalaureate degrees were cut to 120. If those decisions are made on the campus and there is no request for waiver, all those decisions will remain on the campus, and then we will simply just reduce the number of credits. They just tell us that reducing the course, the baccalaureate degree from 124 to 120, we will record that because we keep track. We try to keep track of that, and we will review only those requests for waivers.
Okay, thank you. It's been rather interesting. Representative Haas, do you want to wrap it up, or are you satisfied? Or Mr. Brandt, do you have anything else to add?
Yeah, if I could just say something in closing, you know, I certainly appreciate being here. I would like you all to know that I think, you know, working through this task force process, we do have a process that is fair, and I think it's rather simple for the users and the campuses to get through. And if they really do need an exemption, they'll get it. And while I certainly trust in the committee's infinite wisdom, I think who better than the system with taking input from faculty, administrators, and students, who better to grant the exemptions than that group? So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the committee members, so they know an individual from the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors is here. They want any information from him. But I just want to thank the committee for its time, for the questions. I think this is the discussion that we need on this issue. I hope we can continue to have that in the upcoming weeks. So thank you.
We appreciate you bringing it forward. Representative Gumpin, do you have a question? Or is just your hand is bad?
Mr. Chairman, I was just curious. I was going to ask Mr. Lopez what is traditionally the private schools traditionally almost guarantee if you go to a four-year program, you're going to be done in 4 years. And I just wondered how, in his opinion, does he think that can be accomplished when that isn't the case? Generally speaking, it takes 5 years to graduate from St. Cloud or Mankato. What is the difference?
Mr. Lopez, did you hear the whole question? You were signing the book there.
Yes, I did.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunter, a lot depends on the nature of the student body and the nature of the program. The private colleges in the state tend to be 120 credit baccalaureate degrees, and if you break down a four years, 15 credits per semester, that works out. 120 works out roughly 4 years. Many of our students have to work in order to go to school, and that protracts the process. As well, you're aware of the fact that our average age in the Minnesota system across our institutions, including state universities, is significantly older than the student population that attends the private institutions.
Okay. If no other questions, Representative.
I'd just like to that point. So that was an explanation, but do we design our curriculum so that if a student came in there and wanted to go full time, they can get a degree in 4 years? I guess that's the question that I heard asked, and I didn't hear you answer that.
I believe that if you had a student who was going full time and had the resources, that it is possible. You wouldn't be taking 15 credits a semester. At some semester, you might take 18. You might do a summer session, but in engineering, by the way, you do frequently take summer programs. So it can be done in 4 years.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that answer because I think it tells me a little bit about the issue that we're trying to deal with here. Is it can be done, but it probably is not the norm, even for the person that's probably willing to take that. I mean, I have three kids. They all went to a private college. They all worked. They had to work. That was part of the deal, and they all graduated in 4 years or less. I had one that graduated in 3.5, and I don't think they got less.
Except after his mother, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I won't. But I guess the point is that I think when parents send their kids to college, I mean, one of the things they're after is what Representative Severson was talking about, is they want to see the process work and want to see something that's doable and get them a finished product that's got something that they can use at the end. And what I heard you say was it's possible, but that's not really part of the design. And maybe that's okay, because the student that you serve is a more of a non-traditional student. So I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But I think it's something we should consider. I think if people choose to go to our state colleges, I think they ought to go there with the same assumption that they can get a degree in 4 years and have something they can leave there with.
Representative Easton, I think just about everyone on this committee would agree with you that if a student chooses to go full-time and has the financial backing and ambition, that they should graduate in 4 years.
And the understanding of what their career major is early on in the process, that is a huge part of it. Speaking as a college counselor who deals with students, that's a big part of it. If they understand what their major is and where they want to end up, they can do that.
If I may, I'd just like to address something Representative Eastland said. I think the programs are designed, and you'll see in the catalog, they are designed for 4 years. What I gave you about the probably is reality. The reality of our students' body and the nature of their financial backgrounds and some of the issues that they need to confront is such that it's more likely that they will take more than 4 years.
Okay. No further questions. Oh, Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair, this is to the bill. I was on some college visits with you this fall, and I heard the same concerns by the faculty, but I think there was a real misunderstanding of what we had passed in legislation last year. And I agree with what the student's testimony was, and I would hope that we could let the task force proceed with their process, and I feel that this bill is premature at this time.
Well, we'll lay it over. We all have a little time to think about it. So Representative Bly renews his motion that House File 2939 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. All those in favor of that, and thank you, Representative Hodge. We appreciate it, Mr. Lopez and Mr. Grant. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Marquardt, House File 3599. And Representative Norton moves that House File 3599 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. And now we're going to get into Job Z here, so this will maybe get even. Recommended to pass, Representative Norton, and re-referred to the Tax Committee.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And I do have a delete all amendment. Representative Norton moves the delete all amendment 1229. Go ahead. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And House File 3599 will help provide economic competitiveness for rural Minnesota. And it's really divided into two parts. Articles 1, 2, and 3 deal with the Job Z program and makes improvements and fixes, most of those recommended by the Office of Legislative Auditor. There last month I did a review and cited a number of things that helps improve that area. And then Article 4 deals with a business investment tax credit as part of the Department of Employment and Economic Development SEED program. So, a little background, first of all, on the Job Z before I got Mr. Mark Loftus here from the department to talk about the bill. But I do believe that what we have here is a bill that will assure the survival and success of the Job Z program and also allow it to help create more jobs in rural Minnesota. Now, as I say that, I have to give a little background of where I've been with Job Z. Mr. Chair, I voted with you and with others in 2003 against the tax bill that had Job Z, because in that tax bill there was $150 million of cuts to local government aid, and I thought that the cuts in LGA hurt rural Minnesota more than Job Z helped rural Minnesota. I still feel that way today. And since that time, I had other concerns as the program went on. You know, was it? I know one of the intents of the bill was to help the most distressed areas, and yet as I was kind of seeing the bill work, it wasn't getting out to the most distressed areas. That was a concern for me. Another concern I had with the bill and the implementation was, were there some businesses who in fact were in Job Z that would have expanded without Job Z? And another area I had problems with was the oversight. Was the business subsidy agreements, were they being followed? Was there proper oversight? And I guess another concern I had, and all these were stated in tax committee, I've stated this publicly in the past, was if I'm a competitor 5 miles away in relatively the same business, was I being put at an unfair competitive advantage because now someone's getting job Z? And the reason I'm excited to carry this bill is because it really addresses all of those areas that I mentioned. It really, and Mr. Loftus can talk about that, but addresses all those areas. And another real crucial component about Job Z is that it has benefited rural Minnesota. There's 150 communities, 350 businesses that have been involved with Job Z. And so it helps rural Minnesota, and it also provides another tool to put in the economic toolbox for rural Minnesota communities. And I know the communities in my area that have used it want it to continue. And so this approach fixes and improves Job Z rather than scraps the program. And I know there's been a lot of debate in the last couple of years. And so this is a benefit to rural Minnesota, and I think it addresses these concerns that we have. And so that's the portion on Job Z, and I'll let Mr. Loftus carry that. And the other thing has to do with creating Article 4 angel investment groups, pools that could pool up to $600,000. There would be a 25% credit, tax credit, to these investors who contribute to this pool that would provide equity to businesses that are starting up. This program would allow for 20 of those pools to develop, with the requirement that 15 of those 20 pools be located in rural Minnesota. So there are some metro benefits to this bill also, but primarily it is a bill that will enhance economic opportunities in rural Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, if I could turn this over to Mark Loftus to kind of go through the bill at this point. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Loftus. I'm Director of Business and Community Development at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We have taken very seriously the Office of Legislative Auditor recommendations, and we agree with almost every recommendation that they made, and that is reflected in the bill and also in our administrative practices that we have implemented that are not necessarily required by legislation, but which we can implement ourselves. We passed out in the package this sheet with the blue border that I think this committee saw. When Commissioner McElroy talked about this program, talked about this, about the OLA report a couple of weeks ago. What we've added to this bill now is along with each line, is a specific action or on the recommendations, but also the specific part of the bill. For the most part, these are Job Z elements. There's a couple of tax code changes, but for the most part, they are within the Job Z legislation itself. So, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like me to go through each section of the bill?
Sure. Okay.
Section 1 is a targeting of the economically distressed areas. It's a definition of targeted rural opportunity community that will give those areas of greatest economic distress, unemployment, and population loss. Under a proposal elsewhere in the bill, a full 12 years of Job Z, 10-year extensions in those areas that do not have those measures of distress. And that gets at the targeting of distressed areas that the legislative auditor recommended. The second section deals with eliminates the deal evaluator, which is a recommendation that the auditor made. Local governments in current law are required to complete the deal evaluator to assess it in terms of the local and regional economy, the impact of the business in the area. We found in the practice of the program, though, that many communities, while they did the evaluator, they didn't actually use it in any meaningful way for decision-making. So we're recommending in this bill to delete the deal evaluator, and in Section 3, to replace it with state-level criteria in which the commissioner must consider these factors, and they're listed in Section 3, determining factors such as whether there is adverse competition by the business that would be receiving the subsidy, whether there's the proposed number of jobs and investment is commensurate with the benefits that they're receiving, whether there's something else that we might use. Maybe we should use one of the other tools that we have available, such as the Minnesota Investment Fund, that is available to us instead of JobZ in every case. JobZ is not necessarily for everyone, and we want to find other ways of determining whether their JobZ should be used. We'll also make determinations of the this is called the but-for test, whether this project in our determination would have gone forward without the assistance, whether this is a project that perhaps would not have relocated from outside the state or would have moved to another state without the presence of JobZ. Those are all the kinds of factors that we use when we examine our use of the Minnesota Investment Fund, for example. All factors we take into account. Section 4 is really the that section covers state-level criteria. Section 4 covers the meat of the recommendations concerning business subsidy agreements. Multiple recommendations in the auditor's report concerning this section, so I'll just kind of list them off. For one thing, developing a standardized business subsidy agreement that we will develop in consultation with the Attorney General. We've already started that process. It doesn't require legislation, but we are to consult with them. We are developing that. We will use the standard subsidy agreement. The section mandates that the commissioner must authorize the agreement for them to take effect. Currently, a local government can execute an agreement and it has the effect of providing the program's benefits, and that would not happen under this program, under these changes. We clarify the definition of these of what kind of jobs can count to include to restrict it to actual employees, not allowing independent contractors or third-party vendors. We're going to be taking it and dealing with that in our internal business subsidy agreements as well. Requiring businesses to report their unemployment insurance data on a separate location, on a specific location that's relevant to that JobZ project. Currently, if a company has multiple locations, they may report under unemployment insurance law collective wage and salary information and job information. This requires them to provide it on a specific location, which will help enormously in evaluating their compliance. We are mandating in this proposal that businesses certify the accuracy of their compliance, of their data, and also that they're in compliance. We are changing the process of the annual monitoring of the compliance and reporting. Essentially, today, because of the business subsidy law, if a business, for instance, completes its two-year term of commitment in June of a given year, we don't get that report until April of the following year because of the business subsidy reporting requirements. So we are going to change that so that within 30 days they are required with the local government to provide a report to us that we can use to determine compliance. So that will shorten one of the major problems that the auditor found, shorten the time of compliance and the review. So that's an important part of this. And we're also providing a stiffer penalty, which could include a determination of non-compliance with JobZ if the statutes are not filed in a timely way. So that section really gets at a lot of the meat of the auditor's recommendations as far as the substance and the practice of our administration. Mr. Chairman, in Section 5, the duration of the zones, we are recommending creating a 10-year duration for all zones. But in those, as I said, targeted communities having a 12-year zone available, so a greater benefit, greater incentive in those areas. And Section 7 and 8 simply clarify who the applicant is in the JobZ statute. There's various references to who the applicant is, and it's intended to mean local government units, but sometimes we may refer to the business or the original zone applicant. The revised instruction then would be to focus on that definition as local government. In Article 2, and I should mention that Mark Peterson is here from the Department of Revenue, the tax attorney for revenue. In Article 2 are some clarifying provisions that relate to much of revenue's responsibility.
Mr. Loftus, since this bill is being re-referred, can you just maybe quickly go over the tax provisions of it?
Okay. Clarifying repayment obligations for one thing, creating a process by which a business subsidy agreement could be amended by our Department of Revenue. There are a couple of instances so far where businesses have gotten just close to their commitment goal, and we've said as a matter of good public policy, it's probably a good idea to think about not kicking them out of the program entirely, but keeping them in for a shorter duration, commensurate with that. So, and also we are in that section with revenue, some increased reporting requirements. In Article 3, the state auditor is given greater latitude and authority, for a better word, to have access to unemployment insurance data to do their audits of the JobZ project as they're required to do. It gives them access to the revenue's M500 tax form. It also mandates that the business complete the M500 tax form. Currently, they are not required by law to complete it. It describes their tax benefits under JobZ. And this would be a mandate that they can provide it, and also with penalties that if they fail to comply. And authorizing the auditor to access other tax information and wage detail that our department maintains. So, Mr. Chairman, those are that's a quick summary of the changes. I'm happy to take questions on that.
Mr. Chair, we could either take questions now or go to Article 4, which deals with the business investment tax credit. But this is it for the JobZ portion. So I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you want to do questions now or do the whole bill and come back.
It depends on the committee if they want to hear about a quick, maybe a synopsis or a quick overview from you. You yourself on the tax issue on it. But, you know, while we're getting into that, I'm just curious. Does revenue know what the cost has been so far of the JobZ program as far as lost revenue?
Mr. Chairman, I number in my head of, I think, over the course of the program, $46 million. Mark is nodding that that's about right.
Mm-hmm. Representative Norton?
Mr. Chair, well, I did have a couple comments and questions about JobZ. Would you rather have him...
Well, if you quickly want to tell us what's in here on the tax part of it, and then we'll open up the questions.
Mr. Chair, on the business investment tax credit, as I kind of explained, it is like angel investment funders who will provide equity to businesses in their region. And they have to be at least five people that form this pool. They can contribute up to a total of $600,000, and they get a 25% tax credit for what they provide into this pool. And there's a $3 million cost of this to the state because they would set up to 20 of these $600,000 pools, and 15 of those have to be located in rural Minnesota and 5 at maximum in the metro area. So, I know we've talked about angel investments before and so forth, but it's be a regional approach to help develop businesses in rural Minnesota, and I don't know if you want to
lots of things in
that. Mr. Chairman, this is a program that was in the tax bill last year. We're bringing it back. This was under our seed initiative.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am pleased with the angel investment portion of this bill. And I don't know if it was Representative Dabney's bill last year, but we did, or Representative Welty, I think several people have it, some of those types of bills. And I am pleased with that. I served on our local school board for 8 years, and I had JobZ bills, or JobZ, they weren't bills, well, they were on the school board. Come before me a numbers of times, and I did have some frustrations, and so I've got a couple questions that if you'll indulge me on, I think I've got maybe three. Can you define rural for me, and is Rochester still going to be considered rural, or still considered under job?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, Greater Minnesota is the location of the job zone. Rochester does have some zone property. Yes, so. It's not necessarily appropriate to call the program a rural program. I would say it's a program for Greater Minnesota.
Thank you. And I used rural because I quoted somebody who used that language, and I had marked that. Okay. Well, sorry about that. That the JobZ identified amount that you can have is going to change, or, for instance, in my community, there was a certain amount of land or square footage or whatever that they purchased, is that going to be able to be expanded, or are they limited to what they've already been approved?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, the acreage is, the total amount of acreage in the state is now fixed. I think it's something like 29,000 acres, and Rochester has a certain number of zones. Currently, I can't remember the acreage that it has, but those are fixed now. Rochester conceivably
in the future could apply for additional acres, but we have no plan to do that.
Okay. Thank you. I think we have like 5 acres left or something to spend, if I understand that correctly. Have you considered, Mr. Chair, if I can continue, have you considered, as I said, as a school board member, I was in times of hardship when states were having trouble and money wasn't coming to the schools, I was, knowing that it was good for the economy, I was being asked to give up my school district tax money coming back to me. And cities and counties have that same issue, though for cities and counties who are often in the business of building the economy, that makes more sense. Have you considered allowing, and I guess my question would also be on that $46 million, if that was a state investment, how much loss there was to schools, cities, and counties, or if that was an aggregate of all. But have you considered allowing some of those local tax entities to not be included in this?
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, answer one of your first earlier question about what proportion of this is property tax and so forth. The greatest proportion so far has been state sales tax, the exemption on construction costs and startup of the businesses. The other question about whether we have considered it, no, we've just taken pieces of the job, the exemptions out. No, we've said it's all benefits or nothing. And I think that was... trying to remember back to the start of the program what the purpose of that was, but it was probably ease of administration for one thing, just that to have 350 agreements with all the same basic benefits that the revenue and we can monitor is probably one of the factors that market or someone else could
hey, Mr. Chair, go ahead if I might, and Representative Norton, remember when this Representative Abrams called this program TIF on steroids, if you remember. And so it is a little bit like a TIF, where for 10 years or so many years, you're not going to get that tax base, but then after that, you do. And it might have been a tax base you would have never received. And the other thing is, as far as the school revenues, if in fact new businesses bring in new families, therefore new students, of course, you have, you know, $6,000-$7,000 per student that will provide additional money into the school district, too. So, you know, there's a give and take on that, but certainly you bring up a legitimate concern.
Let's get a clarification for the committee and Representative Norton from revenue then. Is the figure you gave us just state taxes to date, or is that local and school district? And you want to sit down, sir, if you want?
No. Don't you?
Welcome to the committee, and maybe you can tell us that. I'm assuming that the $46 million or whatever that number was is just to date, so we have 9-10 more years or 8-9 more years left, number one. And number two, Representative Norton's question, were you just talking state taxes or were you talking county and city and school?
Representative Rizzini, Chairman, my members of the committee, my name is Mark Peterson, I'm an attorney at the Department of Revenue, and the $46 million is the total of all taxes, which is right now and through 2006, and includes about $4.2 million on the property tax. The rest would be in sales tax and income tax.
Representative Norton, and follow up. And then
I had just one more, and thank you for that information. And then the last question I had to do with your consideration of extending the program benefits to 10 years for current job Z. Identify, because I have a little bit of a problem with that. Those folks took the job Z and chose to build there with a specific amount to count on, and so if it's new property, that's one thing. If it's extending the old, I have a little bit of an issue. My existing businesses in my community don't think it's fair.
This is Chairman, Representative Norton. The answer is, if you have an existing agreement, you're bound by the current 2015 deadline. This would only apply to new agreements.
Representative Gunther, was it to this point? Or
it was
a couple other people.
Point, yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask Mr. Peterson, I think his name
was. Mr. Peterson is, yep, he's around
here. I was going to ask him, if the cost was $46 million, what were the benefits to the Department of Revenue for having and creating all these jobs at the same time? Is there any counting for that?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Council, Department of Revenue, I don't think has done any of that analysis. I know Deed has done some of that kind of analysis. I don't think Revenue has.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr.
Loftus might have a number.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, the
remembering the number of jobs created as reported by businesses, something in the range of 5,400, and the capital investment number that escapes me now in total. The legislative auditor questions those numbers, the job commitment, job reported numbers, and the capital investment numbers. As we go forward, that the kind of evaluation that you're talking about, the tax benefits for the jobs created, I would feel more comfortable standing here, sitting here a year from now, reporting on with these changes and reporting on the compliance and whether the benefits have been, as measured, are more of the investment, which is a matter of public policy then.
Representative Haas. I was wondering if the zones that were first established, that's the zones, and they're not growing, but they still have a borrow plan. You can still trade monopoly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, yes.
Okay.
We describe it as collaboration among communities.
Okay. Representative Mahoney, who just said I'll write those words down. All right,
thank you,
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to go back to a question that Representative Norton asked you about 29,000 acres. And it's been a number of years since this came to the committee. And I thought they had 50 or 55,000 acres of possible land. Am I right in that? Didn't we authorize that up to that number?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, yes. We were allowed by statute to authorize up to 50,000,
okay,
which would be 5,000 per zone.
So then my next question is, if you've already authorized 29,000, it was kind of not very clear. Are you saying that you're not going to authorize any more? Or you will authorize up to 50,000 if someone comes in and asks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, our plan is to keep that 29,000 acres total cap. We have no plan to add acres. There's enough, to Representative Haas' question, there's enough acres out there that if the community is short acres and they need to borrow it, we have no plan to increase the number.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the answer to that. I was on the committee when this originally came through. And no offense to my colleagues from regional centers, but this was sold at the time as a small-town rural economic development tool. And it's very, very clear that this has been successful in the regional centers and not in the small town. So this has been totally turned around. There's no evidence that those particular things would not have happened in those regional centers if these had not been there. I don't know, and I won't speak again today, but I will tell you right now, Representative Marquardt, and we talk often because our offices are right next to each other, and you know how I feel about jobs. There is absolutely no way you can fix this program. You are taking tax money from the small business person who has been in the town, started the town, supported the town, and giving it to the new guy down the street because he or she is prettier, fancier, or whatever. This is a bad deal, and I will vote against this bill or anything that has Job V in it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, we've had a number of late night discussions. You're coming back from wherever and past midnight, and and these are some of the things I said in the onset. What you said, I also have those concerns, and I agree. Initially, this program, I thought, was for the most distressed area, the smaller places, and the retail or the regional centers have, because they've got the infrastructure in place and things like that. So there's other things, but I do believe that it is a program that has helped rural Minnesota. Everyone I've talked to, as far as the cities and community developers that are involved with this, like the program. And I do think that, like Subdivision 4, Targeted Rural Opportunity Communities, they define that. And there's another portion that talks about they've got to consider whether or not it's adversely impacting other companies in the area as far as an economic disadvantage. So my feeling on this, and I've had legitimate concerns publicly, is that
We need to fix it and try to approve it because I think it's helping rural Minnesota. If we just scrap it, we've lost a tool that I really firmly believe are helping communities out in greater Minnesota. And you know, we can come back in a year if this isn't working yet and try to tighten it up further, but my thoughts is we try to fix it and improve it because I think that will work, but we might have to come back again.
Members, we've got a couple more members on the list here, Representative Eastland and Norness. Let's approve the minutes first while we've still got everybody here. So Representative Slocum moved the minutes of the February 27th meeting, and you weren't here, so Representative Welke moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And Representative, who moved the, who did I have move the, Representative Norton, you moved the amendment, right? So let's vote on the amendment. All those that are in favor of the 1229 delete all signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Eastland. And we're going to try, we got to be out of here at 15:15.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler, I apologize. You probably can leave. We'll have you first up tomorrow, okay? I'm sorry. I didn't get my bill heard either. Follow me, Jim. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Mahoney's concern. I know he's not an advocate of Job Z. But I think we have to be willing to look at all the sides, and I'm kind of going back to what Representative Norton mentioned. You know, the jobs that come into the community have a residual effect, and I'm not sure I agree that a community that the county and the city and the other areas of government have a different interest in this than school districts. I think a community is a community. And we all support each other. One of the reasons why Job C is successful in regional centers is because of the schools. It's because the employers want to locate where there are good schools, because that's where they can get the they can attract employees. But I mean, new employees buy homes. They pay property tax. New employees have other jobs in the community. If one of the spouses works in the new plant, the other one works somewhere else. The students bring new revenue into the school districts. So, I mean, there's a residual effect here, and I don't think we can measure it. But I think your concerns, Representative Marquardt, I think are valid, that we need to make sure that this system is working. And then I've heard a lot of concern about the unfairness that this poses to an existing company. And I think there's a time where that may be a factor. But I think if you just observe what happens in the real world, if you look at communities usually develop kind of a character. In my community, we have a lot of ironwork. We have a lot of machine shops. We have a lot, and we use Job Z to get more machine shops in. And they're competitors in one sense, but they also share work. If you look at any the way automobiles are sold today, you drive down the road, they all locate right across the street from each other. There's a continuity that kind of happens when like businesses locate close to each other. So it isn't always true that because there's a machine shop here, another machine shop is not desirable. And I think the economy dictates that a little bit. And communities are sensitive about that. Our community in particular is sensitive about that. They're not going to pursue a job that's going to be a direct competitor to a major industry in our town. They're not going to pursue a Job Z potential for that reason. So I think we got to give the system and the economy and all of that some credit. And I think it's working. And I think in a year from now, when we have a chance to put all the pieces together, I think we'll have a better picture of how all of the economics of this thing work. I think it's pretty complicated, more complicated than we initially thought. But I think it's going to yield a good result.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Mahoney's comments, I happen to live in a regional center, and we have been one of the communities that has really benefited from the Job Z program. And most of the benefit has come, frankly, from expanding local businesses that are already there. I can't think of any that have actually moved into town to compete with existing businesses. It's been businesses that have been there, and this was a way that they could expand, and it's been tremendous for our community. And I think another reason the smaller communities perhaps haven't been as active is that, you know, we have the advantage of having a full-time economic director, somebody that works with this program. Smaller communities don't have that, and I think it's taken them a while to understand it and to realize the benefits. I'm working with a community in my district now that is finally deciding, you know, they need to do this because it affects the school. They need more students. I mean, it just takes longer for them to and also they didn't set aside any acreage, so now they have to figure out how they can do some trading. So I think rural Minnesota will catch up here. The smaller communities will do all they can to make this work. And I'm glad to see that the extension is there, the 10 and 12 years. I think that's important so that we don't have a declining benefit here, but we have a benefit that's actually going to be paying off in the long run. I've also had a couple of community businesses that have chosen not to be involved in the JobZ program. So it doesn't fit everybody's, there's some that are expanding without this program. So it's just another tool, and I think it's very important that we keep this one available.
I guess the question, Representative Norris, is would they have expanded your businesses whether this program was available or not? And that's where a lot of the rub comes in. But I understand
that. I would guess in most cases, no.
You know, I come from rural Minnesota, too, and I got a lot of ups and downs in my area. We haven't had any job growth because of this, because I suppose we're more natural resource tied maybe than other areas. But I understand a lot what Representative Mahoney was saying. And I just want a question before this bill goes out of here, and that is that the wage requirements, 150 or 70% of poverty, and the prevailing wage requirements, I think, for construction, and all those things then are still in the bill, right?
They're all still there, yes.
Where?
And is it 110%? I thought it was
110%.
So, does anybody get employed in this program qualify for, you know, food stamps and things like that? 110% of poverty? Or worker family credit? I thought it was
170.
Oh, okay. Maybe we can change that. We should do it in this committee. What is it?
110% of the poverty level for a family of four, which currently is $10.92 an hour.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly the question I was going to ask. That's only for 75% or more of its employees. So, if I'm reading this right, you can still have 25% of your employees are employed below that wage. Am I reading that right, or am I wrong?
Mr. Loftus,
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think you're referencing Article 4, which is the Emerging Tax Credit program. That also, by the way, does have a requirement of, for those employees, beyond the first five of the people who start the company, the people they employ, to pay them that 110% of the poverty level. I'll try to answer your question.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
25% of the people can be below that, according to this. So if you want it to be 100%, let's change that 75% to 100%. If that's what you're going to claim.
That's on the tax credit.
Right. I mean, I actually, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, I had a question about where the wage language is in the rest of it, because I can only see it being crossed out, and maybe I'm just...
I think it's referenced on several... Our references to statutes here, like on page 3, but I'm not sure. Council, where are the wage requirements? Are they still in the other parts of the law that's not being monkeyed with?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Loftus?
It is in Article 1, Part G, line 2.28 on the second page.
Okay. All right. So, Mr. Loftus, the question raised by my staff is the those wages that you cited, does that include just wages or is that wages and benefits?
Mr. Chairman, that can include wages. That can include benefits, yes.
So, if they get
401k for 50 cents an hour or something, that's included, they can make then $9 or something like that an hour.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct.
Members, does anybody feel uncomfortable passing this out right now without looking at it a little deeper, or do you want to just let it go to tax committee and worry about it there and fight it out on the floor if you've got any concerns about the other things that are in it? Representative Clark is a senior member of the committee that's been on these issues for years, but you...
Mm-hmm. Well, I am just a little concerned about the wages. What is 110% of poverty for families for? What are we talking about? I can't remember what that is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mark, in 2007, 110% of that would be $22,716.
Which is per hour or what?
$10.90.
But that includes benefits.
That would
include the week vacation or health insurance or whatever, that includes that in there.
I see, so it could be lower.
Members, I'll move on line, page 2, line 2.29 to move that figure to 130% of poverty if they're getting these kind of breaks. I think 130%, that'll at least give a little more. Representative Marquardt, any comments on that?
Mr. Chair, that's $26,845. Mr. Chair, I don't know what was all the rationale that went behind the 110%. That's been in this law, Jobs v. Law, since day one, hasn't it? Or when was that?
Jobs v. Law is 5 years old.
Right. I can't comment because I don't know what the rationale was when it reached 110%. So I don't know.
Comment, Mr. Lofton.
Mr. Chairman, that's also the provision, I think that comes from business subsidy law that governs our Minnesota investment fund, for instance.
Now, Representative Clark had a lot to do with those numbers in the beginning, because I know she was working on corporate welfare, as she called it, for many, many years. So
I'm not sure that the 110% is actually right, but... maybe if we could have an agreement to work on these numbers. And one of the things is I don't like that 25% of the workforce can be at this living wage. So I guess that's another issue with the tax credit. And I just, maybe if we could agree to work on that between now and the next committee.
Representative Marquardt, is a fiscal note accompany this with the, or is it the revenue pretend that it doesn't?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there's a...
If it was my bill, it'd have a fiscal note on it.
Mr. Chair, what Representative Park saying, certainly we'd be willing to work at that. I just don't know what the impact would have on businesses and so forth by going on the fly here and raising numbers.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina. And to Representative Clark, I actually worked on the Angel or the Regional Investment Tax Credit during the last couple of years, and we had... a lot of discussion. I had a lot of discussion with personnel from BEAD about what percent of poverty level should our requirement be set at, and then also the 25%. The reason why we got to the 25% is we figured that the owners who are putting in some of the dollars into creating these businesses, most startup businesses and the owners end up taking a hit in the first couple of years when they start up their business. So we wanted to allow those businesses to have some flexibility so that the owners or the partners who were involved would not have to meet that threshold. And so that's why we have that 25% exemption.
Well, it would be my suggestion, members, we'll move the bill out and we'll work with Representative Marquardt, and because I have some concerns too. And then I would hope, members, we could get here tomorrow on time because... we do have a number of bills that got backed up, and I apologize to the commissioner and staff from BEAD that we didn't get to my bill. So we've got the Norton motion, that House File 3599, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Tax Committee. Any further comments? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails.
Now, Mr. Chair, thank you so much.